Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us for this unfolding conversation of what's going on in the financial markets. I'm Annette Parker, Vice President and Treasurer of the College, Dickinson Class of 1973, Fine Arts and Art History major here at the College, and now the CFO of the College in these challenging times. We'll be joined today by four alums who have graciously taken the time from their positions as financial professionals around the world to help us understand what's going on in the financial markets and how this affects the College and each of us personally. First of all, a few points of business. The disclaimer from our colleagues who will be joining us is that they're speaking to us as alums, not from their professional positions, so any opinion that they give to us is from their own thoughts, their own lives, and not as a representative of the businesses where they work. Additionally, there will be handouts available. Some have been handed out. I'm not sure we have enough, but all materials and others will be presented on the College's website after our meeting today. Additionally, I'd like to ask you to please turn off your cell phones now. A couple of thoughts then about why we're here. We'll ask each of our participants to speak to us for about 5 minutes about what they think is happening relative to the stock market, to liquidity, to the global credit crisis. And then we'll open the floor for your questions so that they can speak to you from their own experience in the financial markets. We'll have four of our good colleagues from the College. We'll go through that one really quick, fast. Michelle Mahoney Richardson, Dickinson class of 1985, is currently Managing Director for Babson Capital Management in New York. Michelle is a structured finance quant, an expert who has worked with Freddie Mac and formerly with Lehman Brothers. So she understands the kind of products that are in the news and will be able to help us understand what they mean to us and how they have been a part of what's going on in this global credit crisis. Brian Ruzick will join us from Geneva, Switzerland, class of 1988, Managing Director for Latin American Investments with Citi Private Bank. Brian has been working in private wealth management for over 15 years in Latin America, and he currently manages portfolios for clients in Brazil, Mexico, Chile, Argentina, and works out of Geneva, Switzerland, bonds, foreign exchange, hedge funds, derivatives, and liability management. He was recently on campus with us as part of the Dickinson 2025 conversation of future leaders at Dickinson who have a great deal to offer us, and we thank him for taking the time to be here just last week and to join us today. Craig Weeks is on our board of trustees, as is Michelle Mahoney Richardson. Michelle is on our investment committee and on our finance committee, chairs the finance committee. Craig is also, he has just moved off the Finance Committee and works now extensively with enrollment management. He's been working with us for several years, Dickinson on Wall Street, the Career Network, and he brings to us extensive insight into the banking industry. And finally, Hans West will join us. He's Managing Director with Investor. Investor is the College's, we call it an insourced solution to our endowment management. Investor actually manages 10 endowments, a total of $6.5 billion, of which Dickinson is a part. Our endowment is managed by this professional group in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hans was formerly with UVIMCO, the University of Virginia Investment Management Company, and before that was the head of fixed income for Mentor Investment Group. He worked as a portfolio manager for Dynex Capital, and he's on the Virginia Tech Board of Trustees and the Advisory Council for the Virginia Retirement System. So he knows institutional investment management very well. We're hoping, Hans, because this is the future of Dickinson's endowment as well. So these four colleagues will be joining us, and then they will be answering your questions today. You know, the headlines are pretty amazing, what's happening right now. I'm seeing everything from Wall Street bust to Germany takes hot seat as Europe falls into the abyss. Trading in Icelandic banks halted pending a further announcement. The Fed now with more junk. Credit crisis update, endgame or end of the beginning? These are very challenging times for those of us who work in the financial industry, but I suggest that it's more than those of us who work in finance who really have a stake in what's going on. You know, I'm reminded by good colleagues that fish swim in water without knowing that they're doing it, and those of us who breathe and live actually swim in an economic and political system that, whether we know it or not, will have an impact on our lives. Our dollars buy less. Our taxes go up. The troubled asset relief program that was passed by the Congress last week for $700 billion may work, and how it will work still remains to be seen, but the problems that we're going to discuss today are multiples of that $700 billion. In fact, the Congress in its discussions was talking about the $700 trillion, not billion, trillion-dollar credit default swap market and what we can do through intervention to make a difference in what happens as a result of that. Yesterday, the New York Times ran an article on Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Franny, thank you, to put them together, pressured to take more risk. Fannie hit a tipping point. Stock market was down over 450 points when I checked earlier today, down more than 30% since October of 07 when it hit its high. Last week, the municipal bond markets were frozen. We cannot borrow as a college. The interbank lending has frozen as well, so banks are not lending to banks. This has significant impact on what we can accomplish as a college and what will happen to each of us as individuals going forward. So I'd like to start with Michelle Mahoney Richardson, who, as I mentioned, is the chair of the Finance Committee of the Board of Trustees here at Dickinson and is an investment professional who works in these areas of structured finance professionally. So Michelle, if you could start us out by talking about what's going on out there, how it happened, and what we should think about moving forward.
Sure. Thank you. I think that when I sort of look at what's going on right now, I sort of feel like, you know, from the mortgage and asset-backed markets, which is where I've focused the last 10 years of my career, we've been in this storm for about 14, 15 months since Bear Stearns hedge funds first started to wind down. And At the simplest level, this is really a problem that is driven by a lack of underwriting standards in the mortgage market which was fueled by a lot of euphoria about where house prices were going, a lot of looking the other way with regard to, you know, whether borrowers had an ability to pay or whether they had any skin in the game with regard to a mortgage, and that really is sort of the and getting those assumptions wrong is really the biggest part of what is driving all of what's happening today across the globe. There are a lot of people who got those assumptions wrong with regard to where things were going. I think that even if you were pessimistic about what was going to happen in housing a year ago, you have been surprised to the downside with how negative things have become and have stayed. And so I think that is creating more ripples in this market. One of the things that you know, I've had discussions about away from work is how did you get to this giant problem from a mortgage market that seems to be pretty pretty manageably sized. And I think that the best way that I've found to describe the credit default swap market, which if you're reading about this, you start to see an awful lot of, and if you and a lot of my friends have asked me, okay, what's a credit default swap? And the best way that I can kind of describe credit default swaps and how they sort of factor into this is to think about them as side bets in on a basketball game or a football game. You've got the actual sort of performance of the game, or in the finance world, you've got the performance of the underlying mortgages in an underlying mortgage-backed deal. But on top of that, you've got thousands of counterparties making side bets with each other on whether or not that on the performance of that underlying bond. And so what happens in very short order is you can have $1 billion worth of bonds generate $20 billion worth of side bets. And this, I think, is... it's the best way I have found to explain how this problem has gotten to be so big and so fast. And so I think that when you think about that piece of it, there's this big there's this $62 trillion market that is hanging out there, and not all of it is bad, and much of it is corporate related and is probably going to be fine. But a component of it is definitely at risk here. The TARF proposal, the $840 billion total of bill that was passed last week, I think has got it may do some good, but I think it's got some limitations. And we had a discussion last week as part of the investment committee meeting for the board that outlined some of these limitations. And among them is how do you value securities? How much, who are you going to buy from? Or do you have healthy institutions that are willing to put up with the compensation caps that are available? How are you going to decide who's going to be the first to get it? So I think that there are a lot of questions there, and it still remains to be seen how that's going to be rolled out. But at the very base of it, the fundamental problem that needs solving is borrowers, especially in high house price depreciation markets, need incentives to keep paying, and you need to reduce the amount of inventory for sale in these markets. And so I think on a longer term basis, the way that this thing gets solved at the asset level is to have some sort of a program, and the government has tried this a little bit with some of the changes to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and some of the FHA programs that they've rolled out. But if you go back to the Great Depression, at this point there was a Homeowners Lending Act, which basically bought up properties, held on to them, ended up not costing much at all, if anything, from a government profit and loss statement perspective, and did an awful lot to get some of the inventory off of the market. And that program is out there, and that may need to be resurrected, although people have been very reluctant to pull programs from that era to come back in here. So I think that's basically what needs to happen to really sort of do a long-term correction on this. I think right now there's much more of a triaging kind of a strategies that are coming out.
Well, thank you very much for that insight, Michelle. I'd like to go a little more internationally now and ask Brian Ruzick, class of 88, if he could help us with a view from the European perspective and the what's going on with what appears to be a global credit contagion.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Annette. And to follow up on what Michelle had mentioned, can you hear me well there?
Yes, we can.
Great. So, good evening, everyone. As Annette said, I'd like to take my few minutes and discuss the credit crunch that's worsening in Europe from a contagion perspective. Europe is, of course, we're across the pond, but we're very much linked in these global capital markets. What was Bear Stearns to the U.S. was Northern Rock to the U.K., and this is where it all started from the European platform. Northern Rock is a big mortgage bank in the U.K. It was nationalized several months ago on liquidity issues, and from there we've been snowballing ever since. Probably not at the speed that we saw in the U.S. Financial markets, but that all came to full throttle over the weekend and over the last week as the Fed was putting together their rescue package. Since Northern Rock, we've had several mergers, several interventions, and several packages, both basically at a national level in Europe, and I'll mention a few just to give you some flavor about what's going on over the last few months. Also in the UK, we had Bradford and Bingley, which is the third largest mortgage house in the UK, intervened by the government, basically taken over. It was mainly a corporate bank. We had a merger between Lloyds TSB and HBOS. Lloyds, a very strong balance sheet, picking up a weaker player, very similar to what's going on in the States with Bank of America and Merrill, J.P. Morgan and WaMu, and some of the other mergers that we've had there. This morning we had Fortis out of Belgium be nationalized in the Netherlands and be purchased, the Belgian portion be purchased by BNP Paribas. So we've gone from the U.K. across to the continent into the Benelux countries. We've had Hypo Real Estate this morning out of Germany, which was given a line of 32 billion euros last week by a consortium of banks backed by the German government that fell through over the weekend. Once the bank saw what was on the books of Hypo Real Estate, they balked and walked away. This morning, Germany came in with a $50 billion package, basically nationalizing the bank, very similar to what's going on in the U.S. We have Dexia this morning down close to 35% in the market. Hypo, by the way, was down 50% at one point. Dexia is a the largest corporate sovereign borrower bank to the sovereigns in Europe. It was down 20-25% by close. Although it's Belgian-based, in a small country, it's a very large bank. Also looking at a bailout there from the Belgian-French slash side. UBS, the largest global player out of Europe, certainly one of the biggest wealth managers on the planet, and the biggest player in the U.S. subprime market. They bought at the top of the market. They bought a large bank in the U.S., and they ended up writing off close to $50 billion in exposure to the subprime and toxic assets, if you will, on their balance sheet. A lot of rumors in the market that UBS was close to filing. Of course, none of those are founded. But in this market, rumors tend to lead certain ways. UBS, of course, got themselves into trouble by extending their private bank and their wealth management beyond and into the investment banking world and into the mortgage and subprime market. A lot of rumors there that they will also be intervened or taken over by their larger, now stronger player in Switzerland, Credit Suisse. Greece, Denmark, Ireland, Germany all announced over the last week to 10 days guarantee of depositors in their main banks. This is an important move because whether they have FDIC like we do at a $100,000 cap or not, the government basically came in and backstopped these banks. For Greece, Ireland, Germany, and Denmark to say that they, as individual nations, will support their individual national banks is a nationalistic move, considering that we have a common currency, a common government, the ECB, but we clearly don't have a continent-wide common policy.
Thank you.
Everybody got together in Paris over the weekend, or the main players, four largest economies, and there was no deal, and there was no agreement. They were trying to hammer out a Fed-style rescue package. Germany balked and said each nation should go their own way, and of course, socialist France under Sarkozy wanted a continent-wide agreement or bailout package. This is getting us into unprecedented waters here as nations go it on their own. If Ireland guarantees their depositors for Irish banks for the next 2 years, and you live in Italy, why wouldn't you want to have your money in an Irish bank that just guaranteed it by the government as opposed to an Italian bank? And since there is free flow of capital and competition in Europe, that just put the banks on unequal balance and competitive advantage.
Now, obviously, huge political issues as well as economic issues, Brian.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't even get to this geopolitical side, trying to focus on clearing up the economics, but absolutely, Annette. And, of course, this will be debated in Brussels for, I'm sure, months and quarters to come. So I'm painting a very brief picture. There's certainly a lot more than that going out there, but Europe is in full throttle contagion here. The question is, what's next? And what can Europe do together with U.S., Asia, and what could be a concerted action here to stem this bleeding, which is very severe? Of course, European markets were down 6, 7% across the board this morning, not helping the opening in the U.S. If we don't have a common policy, yet we've got a common currency and a common government, what else is left? Well, we've got the ECB as a central bank for Europe, leaving sterling and, of course, Switzerland out, which aren't part of the euro. ECB could lower rates, very much like we have been in the U.S. and the Fed has been doing. The problem with lowering rates in today's environment is we're not facing a situation of the cost of capital, but the availability of capital.
Absolutely.
So if Fed funds in the U.S. go from 2 to 1, it may not help us at all. And if ECB rates go from 4.25 down to 3, as the ECB mentioned in the last meeting, they would be willing to lower rates if the situation was more dire, which it clearly is. That may give us a short boost of confidence and psychology in the market, but it may not stem the problem, which is the unwillingness of banks to lend to other banks.
Well, you're hitting a huge point there on liquidity. I'd like to ask Craig Weeks if he could help us to think about liquidity, and then we'll come back to you, Brian, for more on the international front.
Sure.
Craig, as a managing director at J.P. Morgan, obviously you deal with the banking industry all the time, and from a commercial banker's perspective, what's happening in the international commercial banking system and how it affects the broader stock markets and financial markets in the United States and in the world?
Well, what my part of the bank does is called trade finance, and that's working with importers and exporters and with banks outside of the United States to finance the physical movement of goods, the construction of goods, and the movement of those goods. So it's where the rubber meets the road between the importers and the exporters and how they get financed. There's a couple of things here that are really unusual. This is the first time, I think, that a crisis has actually started in the OECD countries and is where people are sort of waiting to see whether it spreads into the emerging economies or whether it won't. Clearly, those banks didn't have the level of investments in the U.S. Capital markets that the European banks did, but they probably have some, and we're sort of waiting to see the degree to which this will spread into, say, Latin America, Asia, Middle East, and Sub-Saharan Africa. There was another very unusual thing that the vice chairman of one of the largest U.S. banks had to go do a tour of South America to reassure their borrowers that their lender was in good shape. It's sort of a Twilight Zone-y kind of a thing for that to happen. We're seeing spreads go way, way up. This is the cost that it costs, the expense that it is for borrowers to borrow. So the spreads have gone way up. The tenors that banks are willing to extend either to their corporate clients or to their financial institution clients, the tenors are significantly shrinking. And the secondary market, which is where if we take on an asset that's too big and we distribute it, we sell parts of that asset to other banks, the secondary market has gotten really, really skittery recently. And in some countries, there's no secondary market right now. And in other countries, it's just become very, very expensive. So one of the major concerns we have is if this does spread into these emerging markets, will the banks, because of the U.S. banks pulling back from these markets, will that create liquidity problems for those banks and cause other issues in those economies and possibly restructurings and things like that? No one's talking about that yet, but it's clearly on some people's minds. So, Annette, from my view, that's where we stand.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to move on to Hance now. Hance, you are daily working in the college's endowment. Our endowment is now about $342 million at Dickinson, and it provides, through our spending from the endowment, about 11% of our operating budget, faculty salaries, scholarships, debt service, all kinds of things that we rely on every day. From an institutional investor perspective, what are you seeing in terms of, certainly we were invested in financial sector stocks, real estate's also going down. I mean, how have we positioned the endowment? What do you see out there, and what do you think is coming next? Hans?
Sorry, I had my mute button on. In terms of the overall landscape, Annette, we are really starting to see what we think are very good investment opportunities for longer-term capital. One of the prior speakers mentioned the need for capital, and I think endowments and other institutional investors like pension funds as well are in some unique positions to help provide that capital. But the price of the capital obviously has gone way, way up in the last year. You mentioned real estate. I think, you know, at this point, the one bright spot earlier in the year had been commodities as an investment, or in commodity-related businesses and companies had been doing very, very well in this environment and had been sort of, you know, a really a bright spot in the markets when markets were sort of doing poorly in the beginning of the year. That changed in July, and since then, commodities have been doing very, very poorly, and they're down like everything else. I mean, at the end of the day, what happens in situations like this, and you know, the markets now globally are delevering on a massive scale, is that just about everything goes one way, and that's down, much like everything was going up in unison several years ago. They're going down, and we're seeing sort of the fear part of the fear and greed equation that drives markets over short term. I think we have been negative on the general outlook for the economy and for the markets for some time, but I think we feel like, whether this is the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end, it's hard to say in the near term, but I think we are beginning to find good values, and that should bode well for the endowment from a longer-term perspective. We're not a levered investor, so we don't have to come up with cash in the current environment, so we can sort of use good diligence and place investments with managers and hopefully profit from this in the long run.
Thank you very much, Hans. I have lots of questions for my good colleagues about what's going on in the global economy, but I'd like to take a chance here for you all to participate. There are students who will have microphones. We'll need you to speak into the microphone so that our colleagues can hear us. Now we're ready for your questions related to these financial issues.
Hi, I'm not sure who would be most interested in answering this, but something that I've read about recently occurring is that as a product of this series of events, there's been a sentiment, a turn against the short-selling side of the market, and that this has been particularly pronounced in other countries like, I think it was Taiwan that recently enacted a full ban on the practice. Do you think that's going to have a major effect on this, and where is this occurring overseas?
I'll take a stab at that from Geneva. I don't think short-selling prohibitions will stem the tide on this in any form or fashion. It may stop it for a week or 2 weeks by disallowing people to sell something they don't own, but it doesn't stop the people who actually own the asset from selling. And when the market moves into this tailspin, sellers are sellers. If you take the shorts out, you take out a percentage, but you don't take out all the sellers. So it's a stopgap that is wishful thinking, in my opinion.
Other thoughts from...
This is Hans. I would totally agree with that. I think you've seen since the ban was put in place in the United States in particular, the markets have not been helped by that, and it may have created a somewhat of an unintended consequence in that while people are not allowed to short sell equities, they are allowed to short sell things like CDS. And if a financial company's credit spreads are widening, that's a far more damaging, you know, real impact on their business than their stock price going down. Certainly their stock price going down can be viewed as a negative and generally is viewed as a negative by lenders, but their actual cost of borrowing rising, which is very indicative in the CDS market, is a far more damaging, far more quickly impact. And I, you know, long run, I think the short selling bans have no impact.
Thank you. Our next question.
Hi, this is Wendy Moffitt in the English department. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
A former student of mine. This is an English major question, which is, if the banks don't know how much things are worth that are declining in value, how can anyone know what they're worth? And how can we assess where the bottom is if banks and experts themselves are having trouble setting valuation?
I'll take a stab at that one. It is the $64,000 question, as we've sort of thought about it here and sort of seen that as a glaring issue out there as to what the fair value is. And we spend a lot of time thinking about what fair value is. And one of the things that's happening right now is that there is nobody willing to buy securities in the structured finance markets, in that you've lost Lehman Brothers, you've got a preoccupied Merrill Lynch, B of A. They are all looking to not take any more assets onto their balance sheet, which means that in the event that you have to sell something, you have to sell it to a very, very distressed price. And what I mean by that is, if you look at you can make some assumptions about where a security is going to perform, and you can make some estimations with regard to what the expected losses are, and you can bang up a bond pretty well. And if you go through all of this analysis to figure out what the bond is worth, and you come out and say, okay, if I want to earn a 20% return, it's worth 75. And what's happening is, in the market right now, that return, which looks pretty good, if you actually wanted to sell something, it might be at 50 or even 35, because nobody wants to own it. And what's happened is that's forced all of these marks, these securities, to be marked down to that $35 level, when a reasonable value might be 75. And so what the goal is, and I know that the Fed is interviewing money managers right now to look at this, is that they would is to try and find some middle ground there between what it's worth adjusting for losses versus what the market clearing level is right now. And I think I think people got a pretty good sense for the loss piece of it. The question is much more, what is the return piece of it? Not sure if that answers your question, but that's kind of how I've been thinking of it.
Thank you, Michelle. You know, one of the things I think is so hard for most of us is that for much of our lives we've had to deal with inflation and prepare for inflation, loss of purchasing power. But since we're all young enough not to remember the Great Depression very well, we are not thinking much about deflation. And yet when we start talking about lowering interest rates more and what's going on in the real estate market, particularly this whole idea of what do we have to prepare for and what's really the bigger threat, inflation or deflation, it makes me wonder about lowering rates some more. Brian, particularly on the international front, you've talked about central banks needing to get together to lower rates in a synchronized fashion. Can that happen? Will it work? And what happens on the inflationary impact of that from not only a European but a global perspective?
Right, yeah, so great question. I think, Annette, that inflation's basically been thrown out by the window by almost all central banks at this point, save for the emerging markets. But if we look at G7, I think at this point inflation is on the back burner. It's the last thing people are discussing, although ECB brought it up in their last three meetings. They certainly didn't bring it up at the last meeting. In fact, they discussed rate cut Injection of liquidity at this point probably won't lead to higher inflation. We have oil below 90, or at least we did this morning. We have commodities falling out of bed across the globe, whether it be copper, gold, aluminum, all of the metals, fertilizers, some of the soft, wheat, corn, almost everything is coming down in price. Not to mention loss of jobs, housing prices, and disappearance of several financial institutions. I think it's very difficult to talk about an inflationary scenario at this point. We were 3 to 4 months ago, but this situation buys us a lot of time to keep prices in check. Concerted central bank moves on lower interest rates globally help? From a psychological perspective, probably, for a day or two for the markets. I don't know if it's necessarily going to actually inject liquidity into a very sick market. Again, I mentioned earlier, the cost of capital is not the same thing as the availability of capital. At this point, Fed funds or ECB rates become inelastic if banks aren't lending to their colleagues. So I think in the current context, just interest rate cut synchronized effort would be very limited in short-term impact. There needs to be a lot of other moves besides just interest rates from central banks. And I would say if we have to lean towards deflation or inflation, deflation would have to win out over the next 12 months.
Other questions from the audience?
Thanks. I got another question for Brian. You told us that Sarkozy and France sort of wanted a European community bailout plan and that Germany balked at that. Can you tell us how open other nations besides Germany and France were to that sort of community bailout, or was there just sort of a general consensus outside of France for individual national plans?
Well, over the weekend they weren't invited, right, which is why Finland has their nose out, all bent out of shape, and everyone else. The only people who went were Germany, France, Italy, and UK. So what little Denmark's opinion is on a continental package is pretty much irrelevant in Paris these days, given the current size and scope of the crisis. Clearly, France is more socialist, and Germany, with Merkel, which is more on the right, their views and opinions differ. Will they come up with a common policy? It certainly didn't seem that way over the weekend.
Craig, do you have other thoughts on that? I know you do a lot of work with international banking as well.
Well, I think one of the things that was interesting was to note that about a month ago or 3 weeks ago, a lot of the European finance ministries were criticizing the United States for our Wild West finance and how their centralized planning and much more tight control over their financial markets was an obviously superior model to the American model. And I think that that statement's sort of been overtaken by events over the last week or so with the interventions that they've had to have, and notwithstanding the fact that some of the biggest players and who have taken the biggest hits in the American markets have been European banks. So I think that if we're sick, they're going to get sick, and I think they probably already are, and that we actually have the chance of coming out of this. The Americans have the chance of coming out of this sooner than they will, because I think they're just sort of going into the cycle now. I'm sure that that Brian has a view on that too.
Absolutely, Craig. And this is just to follow up on your comment. This is affecting the currencies in Europe. If we look at sterling, Swissie, and euro, they're all 15% off their highs just over the last several months. And that's basically the feeling that you just mentioned, that the U.S. will come out of this first. It may not be to the end of 2009, and that Europe is just entering into this downturn on the banking side. Hence, the dollar is in favor at this point versus European currencies.
Hence, I know that Alice Handy, who's actually the chief investment officer for the college, is currently in Brazil with Tarpon, one of our international managers down there. Do you have any thoughts on what she's seeing?
Well, the Brazilian market is it's an interesting day to be in Brazil, because the Brazilian market today is probably one of the worst performing equity market in the world. I know they have halted trading several times, and the market is down over 10%, and at one point I heard it was down 20, but I don't have a live quote on my screen.
and the currency is weakening as well. I mean, I think the from a broader international perspective, I think the interesting thing, or an interesting thing, there are lots of them, but is sort of two things. One, I think, as Michelle maybe stated earlier, this has really been going on in the credit markets and started in the structured finance markets in July of August of last year. And the credit markets have been steadily deteriorating, and the equity markets in general globally have sort of not been paying a lot of attention to it. The equity markets had sold off, but sort of the carnage you saw in the credit markets in all phases. I mean, you mentioned Dickinson earlier having borrowing difficulties. That's not germane to Dickinson. That's all municipalities, and particularly colleges, having difficulty accessing the municipal bond market, or the price of the municipal bond market that they could access is extremely high, has really, in the last month or so, really just kind of come to the fore in the equity market. So I think more people are aware of it because the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now fallen by quite a bit. This year it's down 26% year-to-date as of this moment. But, and, you know, internationally, I think we started off with the view of decoupling, which was that this was a U.S. problem, as Craig and Brian both mentioned, and that you were going to have this notion of decoupling internationally. The emerging markets have been growing very strongly the last several years. They really did have an inflation problem, particularly on the food and fuel front. And, you know, the U.S. was kind of viewed as the weak sister. And I think what has come to play is the myth of decoupling has been pretty much shattered. And people are realizing you couldn't have a global upturn with everyone going up together without having sort of the global downturn, everyone going down together, and that all of these financial institutions and the money flows globally are inexorably tied together, and banks in the U.S. Have large presences in international markets. International banks have a large presence in the U.S., and we're sort of all in this together. So in that sort of new thought paradigm, it's interesting to me that you've seen the dollar actually strengthen fairly substantially in this environment, with the exception against the Japanese yen in terms of the really major global currencies. But, you know, Brazil in particular, I think, you know, Brazil, if you look at just the sort of the balance sheet and income statement of the country, is in fairly good shape. They have very high real rates of return. They have a trade surplus, and all of that. But, you know, because they are a very commodity-related economy, as commodities have really been hit in the last month or two, you know, the Brazilian stock market has gone down, and it's people in general, as I start off my statement, are massively delevering, meaning leverage investors have to sell. Lots of other investors are scared and want to sell. And when that happens, you know, the selling sort of can get more selling, and you had sort of this global market downturn that we're sort of in the middle of. And governments sort of around the world are sort of taking their own approach to it. Brazil was one of the more hawkish central banks out there because they've lived through hyperinflation, and so their central bank mindset is to never repeat that. I think a little bit that's the issue with the ECB, is their sort of touchstone is to never allow inflation to get out of control because of the experience of Germany in the 20s and the 30s, and that having a direct impact on the start of World War II. And in the U.S., the touchstone is exactly opposite of that. It's the Depression of the 30s, and Ben Bernanke is probably the preeminent student of that, and the mindset of that institution is never again to let that happen here. And so I think you've seen the Fed be much more aggressive than a lot of foreign central banks because of that institutional mindset, but also because of where we were in the economy. I mean, the inflation had definitely gone up in the U.S., but it was much, much less so than a lot of the emerging economies like Brazil, but particularly in Asia, where food and fuel were really driving these double-digit annualized inflation rates. And it's much more of a social unrest problem in those economies when particularly food prices really skyrocket. I mean, earlier this year was a problem with rice shortages, et cetera, and you know, that really gets political attention. But I think, you know, Brazil is, Yeah, and you mentioned Tarpon in particular. We do have an investment in Brazil with a manager. We have great confidence in them, and you know, but the market is kind of ugly no matter, and I think Brazil actually physically is better prepared than many to sort of ride this out.
Thank you.
And Nat, this is Craig. Yes. Brazil a few months ago had the one of the largest discoveries of oil offshore. It should make them a top five proven reserve country, and you know, when they start going for it. And this did nothing but make them absolutely 100% sure that God is indeed a Brazilian.
Thank you. Other questions from the audience? Michael?
Hi, this is Michael Fratantuono. Brian, you suggested that other solutions might be needed in light of the crisis. I think back to the 1930s, and at that time there were liquidity problems, meaning even if more money had been provided, the borrowers were not interested in borrowing in order to build new plant and equipment because of expectations about the future being not so good. And that led Keynes to talk about a liquidity trap and then to advocate increased fiscal spending, deficit spending, if you will. In this instance, it seems like the difficulty is coming not on the borrower's side, but on the lender's side. And wondering if the implication is a return to Keynesianism in the short to medium term. That is the recommended policy increased fiscal stimulus, or is the recommended policy fiscal conservatism and a halt on government spending?
Well, I think it depends who you ask, but I think from a European perspective, they would clearly be leaning more towards the Keynesian solution. More government spending, not to mention nationalization of the banks, which is apparently where they're going with this guarantee of the deposits. It's the next step. That doesn't go over as well in the U.S. under the current administration and in free markets. Europe, which is more socialist-leaning and has more of a history, is probably a little easier to do. But I think right now, no one knows what the solution is here. But clearly, what we've been doing so far, piecemeal, institution by institution, isn't working. And the package, which was approved on Friday, whether we get a European one or not, seems to be too little too late. At least that's the price that the market's putting on it. And so the question is, well, what else can we come up with? Whether it's lender or borrower, to me it seems that this distrust between institution and institution that aren't willing to lend to each other because they don't know what the other has on their balance sheet needs to be cleared up. Whether the Fed or the Treasury becomes broker, clearing agent, some form of a confidence builder between the institutions would go a long way. European, it looks like the solution may be much different, and it looks like they're leaning more towards nationalization as these banks falter.
Other thoughts from our panel?
I definitely think we started out this crisis, and first there was things were okay, and the various government officials came out to say things were okay. They've now reached the point where it wouldn't surprise me actually if they did it, whatever they did. And you'll probably see a host of things. You could see a very large interest rate cut. The Fed announced today they were massively extending the, Michelle, correct me if my acronym, the TAF,
yep,
that went out today, from $450 billion to $900 billion, which is sort of a lender-to-lenders type facility. They are going to pay interest on bank reserves and various other things. So, it wouldn't surprise me if you saw sort of a massive Keynesian response. I don't think you'll get that before the election. That's going to be a tough pill to swallow. But after the package on Friday was so acrimonious, I just don't think they can browbeat enough votes out of the Congress to do that. But going into the next year, if things aren't better, some kind of larger, another stimulus package or fiscal package where they do something on that side would not surprise me at all. In fact, it's probably going to happen in some way.
Other questions?
I just wanted to clarify on the TAF, and I've had friends sort of ask me, is this, backdoor to this, to help this situation. And just to kind of clarify, basically the Fed is in the market every day as part of their open market operations trying to maintain sort of equilibrium with regard to the Fed funds rate, and in this case, LIBOR, which has been stubbornly high. And so what they're trying to do is fuel liquidity and sort of attack it by flooding more cash in the market to bring down LIBOR. And it hasn't really been all that successful, although it isn't creeping up the same way that it was a week ago. But that's basically, this is not a new process for them on a day-to-day basis. The magnitude of it is quite new, though.
Good day. My name is Ray. You guys have done a great job describing the situation as it is. A two-part question. What are the creative ideas and solutions to increasing global liquidity? And then secondly, who are the winners? Countries, industries, companies, when this all settles out?
Is the crystal ball cloudy?
Well, I mean,
no one has used the word winner in this in any way. That's really hard to think of.
Yeah, it is hard to think of the winner. I mean, I think the improving liquidity, I think at the end of the day, people kind of have to be reminded every so often, liquidity is really confidence. It has nothing to do with money in a physical sense or in an electronic sense these days. It has more to do with the confidence and the willingness to do things that are very ordinary course in most environments, which is execute a trade with a broker dealer or to put money in a money market fund or to put money in your bank account or what have you, and then there's the ripple effects that goes through the economy. That's what creates liquidity, is confidence. And right now there's not much of that. So, ultimately, confidence generally comes back in situations like this, and things kind of cease getting worse, and someone steps out because spreads get wide enough, or prices get low enough, and it sort of just starts. But trying to time it is, or trying to pick when that will happen, or the specific event that creates it is difficult. As someone said, the winners. I'm not sure there are a lot of winners in this. Maybe, I think certainly so far, at least in the short run, the winners have been the very large banks that seem to have the better balance sheets, just their people have more confidence in their ability to withstand the impact, or that they're in somehow, say, tied into the government. I think the J.P. Morgan's, the Bank America's, some of the large insurers, Berkshire Hathaway, those tend to have thus far in the short term been the winner. Whether they're the winner in the long run, it's difficult to say.
Other panelists? We have time for one more question, I think. One more question? We'd like to thank you all very, very much for taking your time today to enlighten us from your perspective on what's going on in the financial markets. We will carry on, and we'll look forward to hearing more from you. Please keep us informed as this all unfolds. Thank you very much.